Mark Twain said, "The holy passion of friendship is of so sweet and steady and loyal and enduring a nature that it will last through a whole lifetime, if not asked to lend money." It's commonly understood that friendship and money are like oil and water. They simply don't mix. But what if the friendship is in marriage and they must mix? What then? Can two people with different views on money find harmony when it comes to dollars and cents? I'm Kim Weir. This is the Art of Friendship podcast. Years ago, popular advice columnist Ann Landers had a really interesting letter that came to her. It was from a girl who was writing about her aunt and uncle, and she said in her letter, "My uncle was the tightest man I've ever known. All of his life, every time he got paid, he took $20 out of his paycheck and he put it under his mattress. Not long ago, he passed away," she wrote. "When he got sick and was about to die, he said to his wife, 'I want you to promise me one thing.' 'Promise what?' she asked. 'I want you to promise me that when I'm dead, you'll take my money from under the mattress and you'll put it in my casket. I want to take it with me.'" The girl's letter went on with the story. She said, "He died and his wife kept her promise. She went in and she got all the money the day that he died. She took it straight to the bank and deposited it. Then she wrote a check for the full amount and she put the check in his casket." You know, when it comes to money and relationships, sometimes it's a laughing matter and sometimes it just is not. Money in relationships can be stressful. Research shows that 77% of couples cannot even talk about money without feeling awkward or without having conflict. Does that describe your relationship? Money tension is a real thing. And of course, it's going to be an issue, finances, in marriage, because when you get married, you are sharing life and you're sharing money and you're sharing money decisions. And money decisions reflect values. And sometimes things that you can't see or foresee happen, and that brings along money problems. The days that we live through can cause financial stresses, but every day can cause financial stresses in every season and every generation. Money is just one of those things that, because we have to manage it, it requires decisions. What do you do when you and your loved one don't always want to make the same decisions? Do you fight? Do you talk about it? Do you ignore it? Do you hope it'll go away? We're going to tackle this thing that nobody wants to talk about. So if you have a significant other, grab him and put him in the room with you and maybe have this conversation together. But if not, you can schedule a time, you can make a plan, and maybe this would be a great catalyst for discussion between you and your spouse, or you and somebody you're engaged to, or you and somebody you're thinking about being engaged to, as you think about what it can mean to thrive, not just in love, but also in money. Let's have this conversation with somebody who's got the expertise to guide us through. Shanti Felden has been a guest with us before. She is a social researcher, a best-selling author with over 3 million books and copies in 25 languages. We had her on to talk about the Kindness Challenge. You'll recall that. She has several books on relationships. She and her husband work together, and they have a book out called Thriving in Love and Money, 5 Game-Changing Insights About Your Relationship, Your Money, and Yourself. Shanti, welcome. We're so glad to have you back.
It's always good to be back with you.
This is going to be a fun conversation, particularly coming off of a season where people spend a lot of money. Maybe we can help out.
Yeah, absolutely. Except I have to say, this is so much about the relationship, not about financial advice.
For us to realize that, we realize it through something like a credit card bill comes. And it's the bill that is the catalyst that can be the thing that helps us see, okay, what's the real issue here? Because for most of us, we really do think it's money. We think the problem is if we could just get on the same page about the money, then it wouldn't be a problem. Or if we had more money, or if one or the other didn't spend as much money. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say the majority of people that have a struggle that involves money believe the money's the problem.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that we did in this research project, because, you know, everything that we do is based on research, right? And we do these big studies, and I know you guys have talked about that before. And it was really interesting doing this one because it is absolutely the thought in everybody's head that if I could just get my spouse to handle money differently, or if I could just get them to tighten up, or if I could just get them to loosen up, or whatever it is, they're constantly focusing, including me, right? Like, this is totally me and Jeff, constantly focusing on the dollars. And it turns out, it's when you have tension around money, it's not about the money. It turns out it is 100% about how money makes you feel and how it makes your spouse feel.
That is so interesting, how money makes you feel. Okay, first of all, I want to give that caveat that this is a book that you and Jeff wrote together. And you're both best-selling authors, but you really do a lot of research on relationships and how that dynamic works and how it can be healthy and how it can be Christ-centered. And so together, this must have been a really interesting project because you're a couple and you got to deal with issues that come up with money. And so as we go along, I want to make sure that you share with us the things that surprised you and how it impacted you and in the relationship that you have and what you were able to realign. But let's go back to that one statement right there. It's not about the money. It's about how the money makes you feel. Mm-hmm. Explain that more.
So it turns out that Jesus knew what he was talking about when he said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Because there is something that's sort of supernatural, honestly, about what thinking about money does in our hearts. And there is a direct tie to a lot of stuff that is running under the surface that we half the time don't even know is there, not just in our spouse, but in ourselves. Like, we can't articulate why something irritates me. Like, why does it irritate me when, you know, I'm at the end of a long day and I'm on the way home from some meetings and I call Jeff and say, hey, you know what, why don't I just pick up some Chinese food, you know, for the family for dinner? And he's like, you know, we got some chicken in the fridge from Costco. Why don't I just grill that and save the money? Like, why does that bug me? And why does it bug him that I would call and ask that? And I would never have been able to articulate that what's the deal is, it's not about that $35 or $40 that Jeff is hoping to save and I don't mind spending. It's about something else. There are expectations running under the surface of how money should work. And there are worries and insecurities and all these different sort of background beliefs that we carry from childhood and how we responded to money in our childhood, like all this stuff that's bubbling under the surface. We don't even know it's there. And so we're fighting about the $35 or $40 for Chinese food, and it has nothing to do with that.
It's almost in some ways like that issue of money, each time it comes up, it's almost like you're taking the temperature. It's a thermometer. It's indicating something else rather than what you see on the surface.
Well, the example for that, so, you know, the Chinese food, again, silly example, but honestly, it's the silly examples that kind of make up our day and make up the tension around money sometimes. And Jeff and I that was a pretty classic example. We would never have been able to articulate it. We started this research, started trying to dig into it and figured out, for example, that what's going on underneath the surface in my mind is, you know, our kids have been doing a ton of different activities, and our daughter is at volleyball games, and our son is doing track, and we never spend any time together as a family. And if we grill the chicken, then there'll have to be a lot of prep time, and then we'll eat dinner, and then there'll be a lot of cleanup, and pretty soon homework has to start. And I'm basically subconsciously thinking to myself, $35 or $40 to buy an hour, a precious hour of family time? Absolutely. And I would not have been able to articulate that. And Jeff would not have been able to articulate the idea that if we keep spending money like this, we're going to be homeless in retirement.
Exaggeration much.
and so neither of those two things were ever mentioned in those kinds of arguments or those kinds of slight irritations on both sides. But that's, again, just a silly little example of, if anyone is ever having any kind of tension around money and finances and why is my spouse not on the same page, and it turns out it really has nothing to do with the money, which gives the big lie to the lie that we have inside that thinks if we just had more money, we wouldn't fight. Mm. Well, guess what? Not true, because that's, I did a lot of research with wealthy people in the process of this research project as well. And they all said, ha ha, when you have more money, you have more to fight about, it turns out, because it's about the stuff that's under the surface.
Yeah, that's like saying, if I just had a house that had more storage, I would never need more storage. And exactly what happens is you fill every nook and cranny and stuff's coming out of closets, whether you have two or 20. It's just not true.
Living in my living room. Oh my God.
Okay. Okay. When you think about this idea of how money makes us feel, I mean, so that's a great insight to have. Of course, the next question is, how do I even get to that place? Because there's just so many practicalities around money. How do we stop and sort of move aside the clutter so that we can actually see what the issues are?
When we started this project, we had to go through that process too, right? Because we honestly, this, after all the years of research and all of the different books and the different, you know, projects where we'd learned, Jeff and I had learned so much about each other. And yet money was the one big issue where we were still not on the same page. So like, I was terrified to do this research project because I knew I would have to actually, like, we would have to figure this out ourselves. And the good news is that it is way simpler than we're usually making it. It is way more simple to be able to really connect. And it starts with really understanding what, and I'll give you how to do this in a second, but it starts with understanding what is going on underneath the surface in me, like why am I thinking this way or feeling this way? Why am I agitated or whatever? And what is it that's going on in my spouse? And one of the number one things that's like a one of the day-to-day factors, we identified five, and this is the one that's the most common in terms of day-to-day friction around money, is that we don't realize that we're not valuing what our spouse is valuing. Like, we know that our spouse is like a different human. We know they're a different person, but in some way we don't recognize, oh yes, this different person is going to care about something different than I will. And oh, by the way, what they care about is just as legitimate.
Okay, now that's where, okay, see, that's where you're getting us off track. I want to know what you care about, but wait, you want me to say that it's as legitimate as what I value? That's where I think some of the stress may also.
Yeah.
So, okay, so let's just say, for example, like I'm thinking through in my own brain, and also because my husband and I have had that same conversation that you had about that. Hey, why don't you stop and get something? And I get a list of everything that he knows is in the freezer. I'm like, what's your point? So we've had this conversation multiple times, but as I'm thinking,
and I need a fist bump.
So yes. in my brain, I'm thinking through, okay, well, what is it that I value money for? Because there are some times where I look and I go, okay, I'm really tight on that. Like, I don't want to spend money on that, which is hilarious to me because most of the time I don't care. Like, I'll spend, but it comes down to, as I think about it, I value experiences. I don't value stuff. I value time and I value convenience. I mean, really, those three things in my day-to-day life are huge. My husband values the sense that one day he is going to be able to stop working. This idea of, you know, security, planning, those kinds of things. I'll have to ask him what he values other than that. I think that's what you're talking about, is really kind of getting a sense of what you even value before you can figure out what your spouse values.
Absolutely. Well, let me give you just a simple example, right? So in our relationship, like many relationships, we found that the most relationships, actually, there is someone who is more of a spender and someone who's more of a saver. Even if you have two savers, usually somebody, one of them, is more comfortable spending money. And so this is an example of a values difference, right? And there could be lots of reasons for it. Like, you're talking about convenience versus security, right? There's all sorts of different reasons for that. But taking that as just one example, this is something, obviously, for me and Jeff. Jeff's more the saver. I'm more the spender. And I'm not nuts, but I'm just more comfortable with it. And everybody else who's out there who's more of the spender type is like, absolutely. Like, it's just fine. And the interesting thing that often happens is that we don't recognize that in, and I'm going to, do you mind if I step on a couple of toes?
Step, girl, stomp. Yeah. Do it.
Is that okay?
All right. Do it.
We don't recognize, especially in the church, we have gotten this, stepping on toes, warning, we have gotten this idea that the saver way, the planner way, the Dave Ramsey way, for example, that is the right way. And so it's like everybody knows that this is just what you should do. That's just the biblical way. Well, it is a biblical way. It's not necessarily the biblical way. Mm-hmm. And so, like, for example, like somebody, we were interviewing this one couple, and the husband was expounding. And this, by the way, this is not a gender thing. We found it was 50-50, men, women, saver, spender, despite the stereotypes. It's not true. But in this particular instance, the husband was more the saver. The wife was more the spender. He was more the planner. He loved, like, spreadsheets and reading Dave Ramsey books and reading Compass practical workbooks and stuff. And he was expounding on how, you know, obviously the Bible talks about you have to count the cost before you build the tower, and you have to count the cost before you go to war. And, you know, we need to make sure that we plan for the days ahead. And that's the biblical way, you know, that's it. And the wife is like, well, yeah, but what about all the passages about trusting God to provide and not worrying about tomorrow? And what about the guy who spent all of his time storing up his money in barns and then never got to enjoy it? Like, there, it is really interesting how much we have placed a value on top of many couples. And instead of saying, you guys need to be led in your relationship in oneness, coming together, talking about these things, rather than having something imposed on you that certainly there are biblical principles, but it may not be that there is one biblical answer. And that is an interesting starting point that, like, makes everybody who is a saver type really uncomfortable, but it needs to be discussed.
It's so funny because, I mean, just even taking tithing, the biblical perspective of tithing.
Very clear.
It is clear, and then it's not, because they tithed what would have been a 10% in the Old Testament. We kind of had this idea that that's what we're supposed to do. But technically, if you want to go by the New Testament model, there's lots of people who gave away 100%.
Right,
and they exactly. And they weren't criticized. There is no 10% limit. So I'm just saying, exactly. Things are not always what we have been led to believe. It is good to study for yourself and to see God's word for yourself. So here's a question. Even in light of that, because there are variables, then when you do come together and you do realize, hey, we don't share the same values, do you have mm-hmm. suggestions for them? What is the process then? One of the things I read in your book is that money's not the problem, that it's the people won't talk about the problem. How do we begin to work through the mismatched values?
So back to the idea of understanding yourself and understanding your spouse, right? Like figuring out what some of these things are, and values differences being one of them. For example, let's just take again, if you're maybe somebody's a saver more and somebody's more of a spender. And for you to be able to actually talk about what is it that you're caring about in this situation, and actually honoring that that matters to them, and that that's like a legitimate thing that matters to them. Now, I probably should pause for just a second, because there's some people who are like, you know, how can you say that every value is legitimate? Because what about a gambling addiction? And so let me give you an example. If you had one partner who says, you know, I really, really value saving a lot of money so that we can like save up for a great vacation every year, like to get away, get the family some rejuvenation time. And it's going to cost several thousand dollars, but saving up for that is worth it. And so we do the vacation every year. The other partner says, well, I really value, like, it's clear that to me that what we should do is every 2 weeks go out on a date night so that we can catch up. So it's not just one time a year, but it's, you know, regular. Every 2 weeks we go out, we budget for that. If you had 100 objective observers, no one is going to be able to say, is one of those right or wrong, right? They're just different. But if you had 100 objective observers that looked at, like, a gambling addiction, you'd have 100 people who said, okay, that's objectively wrong. Most of the time, though, you don't have that. And so truly, it is actually being able to talk about what matters. And really, the key is honoring, trying to get underneath the surface and honoring that this thing my spouse is talking about actually matters to them, and it's legitimate. An example from our life last year or 2 years ago when the pandemic first started, you know, being more the spender, and Jeff being more the saver, when the pandemic shut everything down, he actually, to his credit, we had been trying to talk about it instead of avoiding it like we usually did. And he, to his credit, came to me and said, you know, I have to tell you, I'm dealing with a little resentment right now, you know, because all of our speaking engagements had been canceled. We still had staff we had to pay. It was a really scary financial time, right? And he said, if we hadn't gone to Disney World last year with the kids, and if we hadn't gone out to eat those times as a family or gone out to the movies, we'd have thousands more dollars in our bank account right now that we could really use now that everything is shut down. And he said, I'm dealing with a little resentment. And I really appreciated that he was able to articulate what was behind that. But then also to his credit, because, you know, we've been trying to work through these things for ourselves, he was able to come back and he said, you know, but I realize that's not entirely fair. Because when we took the kids for 3 days to Disney World, we were building memories as a family. And when we would go out to bowling as a family last year or go out to dinner occasionally, we were building connection and togetherness. And now we're stuck in quarantine on top of each other and we like each other. And he said, I realized that for me as a saver, he said, I think of spending money as being just a net cost. That's it. And you were viewing spending money as an investment. You were building something. And he said, you know, I still would have done it differently. It's not like he suddenly magically agreed with everything. You know, he said, we could have gone to have free picnics in the park instead of going out to eat, you know. But he said, I understand what you were doing. You were trying to build togetherness as a family. And here's what that did. All of a sudden, everything in me that usually got defensive whenever he wanted to talk about money with me, everything that used to get defensive, all the walls just started dropping because I felt really heard and honored. And it made it much more easy for me to be able to talk with him about the austerity plan that we needed to do now that we had a pandemic. But that would never have happened well before. And so that's just a little example of if you've been so frustrated about how on earth do I get on the same page, one of the key tools is instead of trying to explain your position more, try to understand what's running under the surface in your spouse and what it is that is mattering to them and honor it. Even if you don't agree, you can still honor it. It really does change everything.
That is such great wisdom. And of course, that's great wisdom that's portable. That is wisdom that applies to all aspects of our relationships. Because at the end of the day, we are two separate people with two separate brains and two separate backgrounds, two separate upbringings, two separate value systems, two separate perspectives on life. I mean, all of that. And so to be able to come to that relationship with an attitude that says, I don't just want to be understood, I want to understand. And that'll go a long way in any marriage. All right, Shanti, one of the things, if I had to boil down sort of our whole first part of the conversation, it's make it your goal to understand and value your spouse's values. But underlying a lot of this really is the whole idea of self-reflection. to thy own self be true, right? I mean, we have to know who we are. I appreciate that you said at the beginning, I don't know why I was spending what I was spending. It took me sitting down and asking myself, why does it matter to me that I pick up dinner rather than make dinner sometimes? Why does it matter to me? Here's another one. Why does it matter to me that when I'm not feeling great, I want to go shop? What's the issue with that? I want to spend money. I would think that self-reflection must happen in order to really thrive when it comes to relationships and money.
It really does. It's not comfortable all the time because, well, part of the reason I think we're all just so busy, we just don't sit down and think about stuff like that, right? I mean, I know I certainly didn't. Maybe everybody else is deeper than I am, but it wasn't something that I did. And yet once I started kind of having crib sheets, once the research started and I started trying to see, oh, wow, these are like common values differences, for example. You know, you talked about, for example, convenience. One of the things that we found is that there tends to be someone who will spend money to save time and someone who's like, absolutely not. I want to spend the time and save the money. And that's an example, right? Convenience. Those kinds of things, once you have a little crib sheet and you go, oh, that is totally what's happening right now, all of a sudden your brain really opens up to it. I know that sounds really funny, but we're just not used to thinking about it that way. It really is about spending just a little bit of time getting used to thinking about it that way. Yeah. And suddenly it's not like deep self-reflection that's complicated. It becomes very easy. The problem is that pretty much like all of our money books and money courses at church and the financial workshops, they skip most of that. And they go directly to, let's figure out the technicalities of how we handle money well. And let's figure out how to put together a great budget. And let's figure out how to get out of debt. And all of that is really good. But the average, what we found is that the average couple, you quoted the statistic earlier, 77% of people can't talk about money to begin with. And they don't know what's underneath the surface. And so they can't, like, why? We're just getting irritated. You know, the budget isn't working. I'm not coming back to that class. And so one of the things that we've spent the last, you know, year and a half or so since the book came out, we've been doing a lot of like virtual seminars and stuff with stewardship ministries at churches and marriage ministries, because one of the things that we found is 23% of people can talk about money well. And guess who tends to go to the Dave Ramsey class? It's the people who can already talk about money well to begin with.
Oh, everybody interesting.
Else, yeah. Everybody else needs to be able to open their sort of eyes up to this stuff that we're talking about as step one. And then step two, they will be much better able to do the budgeting and get out of debt and the stuff that they have to do technically.
Okay. One of the things you mentioned before is that when your husband came to you and talked to you, his comment was, I'm feeling some resentment about. And yet under that resentment was really a fear of not having what he was going to need when he needed it. I know that your research really discovered that fear can be a catalyst for a lot of issues. Walk us through that, because we don't want to be fearful people, but it would be interesting to know what happens when we act on fear and how it affects our relationship.
The fear thing is really, really interesting. And it's basically the easiest way of explaining it is picture those kind of instinctive gut level fears that seem very obvious to you, but that the person sitting next to you may not have. Like for me, it's a fear of height, right? Like, I don't know what it is. If I'm on a high bridge, I can't even look. I'm for some reason, I just have this feeling that it's going to pull me over the edge. It's stupid, but it's real. And I don't understand how Jeff can like pull me closer to the edge and go, hey, come here, take a selfie. And I'm like, are you nuts? Like, can't you tell that we're about to fall over and die? Well, it turns out that with and around money and everything related to it, we tend to have different sets of these kind of semi-irrational gut-level fears where we feel like we're going to fall over the edge of a cliff, so to speak. And for one person, what they're feeling is going to pull them over the edge. is really real and it's very obvious. And the other person, that just might be a, okay, I can see that kind of. And it's not taken as this huge, deep need. And one of the classic examples of this that we actually saw really strongly in the data is actually quite tied to gender. It's not entirely this way, but it was about 75 to 85% of men and about 75 to 85% of women, where men, the fear, the cliff that's kind of there pulling at them is the feeling of, am I going to be able to provide for the family? Am I going to be able to provide? Like feeling like that edge is just there and I may not be enough to keep the family from falling. And so what you do when you're confronted with this sort of semi-irrational fear is you try to back away from the edge, right? Like, what can I do? I work longer hours. I'm always available to the boss when he texts me at 11:30 at night. You know, I cancel going to see Johnny's football game because the boss needs me to come into the office. And for the average guy who has that, am I going to be able to provide fear? That seems very real. Like, that's just an obvious trade-off that you make to stay away from the edge. But the average woman, statistically, is just as likely to be worried about money from a technical standpoint. But the average wife doesn't necessarily have that cliff fear of, am I going to be able to provide for the family? Now, 30% do, but 70% don't. And so for them, it just isn't pulling at them. And what's pulling at them and their cliff, we found statistically, for most women, is not so much, you know, are we okay financially, but are we okay? Like, is everybody happy? Is everyone, are the kids feeling loved? Are we okay, you and me? And if you're working all these hours and if you're canceling going to Johnny's football game, we're getting closer and closer and closer to this cliff of being pulled over, of potentially having some real issues in the family or the marriage or the kids not feeling loved by their dad. And so you try to back away from the edge. And that often means doing stuff together, which often involves spending money. And that pulls him towards his edge.
So interesting. So you're basically, in some ways, without knowing it, aggravating and undermining the very fear that your partner is striving hard, often affecting the money issues, to get away from.
It's a very, very common dynamic. Not with 100% of couples, right? Like, some couples won't recognize this all at all. But some couples listening to this are like, oh, yes, like, that's a common thing.
Interesting. And of course, being aware of it is the first step, and then being willing to share it is the second step.
Talk about it.
Yeah. As you've worked with people and helped apply these things in real relationships out in the real world, how have you seen these conversations go? Or what are some of the things that are important to recognize?
Well, you know, the key, just like with understanding the other person's values, the key is showing that you really want to understand and honor what it is that they're fearful about, rather than why would that bug you? Like, the average, this is a classic, slightly stereotypical, but there's statistics underneath it. The average husband is like, why would you ever think we were not okay in our relationship, just because we're arguing or I'm spending a lot of time in the office or whatever? Of course I love you. Like, how could you think that my heart is distant from you? But for the average wife, that really feels like that cliff edge is there. And he just doesn't see it that way. Like, of course there's no cliff edge there. And so that's an example of, instead of going, why would you ever think that? No, I need to work 100-hour weeks, to be, for the husband, for example, to be able to say, you know, this, what can I do to reassure you? What would it take for me to show you that I am totally here for you and little Johnny? And for the wife to be able to say, you know what, just don't cancel the football game. Like, anything else we can talk through, but while he's young and he needs his dad, just don't do that. And so for the husband to say, okay, that's an example of like a bright line rule that I'll just have to have a boundary. And then on the reverse, for her to not kind of poo-poo, that he really has this fear about, am I going to be able to provide? And that it's a real thing when she wants to, like, you know, get little Johnny and go to dinner near his office so that they can have dinner. Well, that's, you know, again, $30 or $40 that is now going to be kind of on the top of his head. So to be able to say, what is it that matters to you that would help you feel better about this? And honoring that rather than saying that you shouldn't feel that way. That those are silly little examples, again, stereotypical, because there's plenty of couples that are, you know, the spender and the saver, for example, are flipped. But we've seen this over and over and over. And the key really is going, oh my gosh, I had no idea that for you, this is a real thing. This is a real fear. I'm so sorry. What can I do?
Communication, empathy, all those kinds of things. It's so interesting because when it comes to money, we do all have, in one sense, a very independent mindset of how we not only handle money, how we want to use money. How do we begin to form this idea of making it a team when that isn't really what your research finds is the attitude that we come into when it comes to finances?
That's a nice way of putting it. The research found that that isn't really the attitude. Yeah, it's sort of
okay. Give us the blunt truth then. Fine.
Well, it's really honestly, you know, starting in the Garden of Eden, we want to do what we want to do, right? Like it's just our, hate to say it, it's sort of a human nature. And when it comes to money, we kind of want to handle money the way we want to handle money. And the issue is in marriage, God makes us one. And we're called to be one in marriage in general. And yet, because of this kind of nature of wanting to do what we want to do, we're sort of resisting being one in marriage in general. And it just kind of happens to come out in how we handle money, along with many other things. And that is an example that comes out in so, oh my goodness, there's so many ways, big and little, like some of the bigger, more obvious ones that ways that we might have a lack of oneness or being resisting being a team in money. It might be as simple as, you know, okay, your paycheck goes into your account, my paycheck goes into my account, and, you know, we pull out however much we need for utilities, and then you do what you want with your money, and I'll do what I want with my money, and you can't tell me what I can do with my money. We literally had in some of the interviews where we were talking to some younger couples, we literally heard some of the couples say things like, oh, you know, we split everything just to be right down the middle, 50-50, completely fair. And so we, you know, trade money for utilities. So, you know, hey, Jack, could you Venmo me $58 for your half of the gas bill?
Wow.
Like that level of...
Do you think that's more of a new kind of a generationally in the last 10, 15 years kind of thing? Or is this couples that have been married, you know, 20, 30 years, 40 years that you see this as well? Just curious.
Well, believe it or not, the technology and the way it works is very different. The heart underneath of it, no difference at all.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you can have a couple who has one account and they still never talk about, like, this is my money over here, you have your money over there, you don't tell me I earn this much, you know, every month with my job, I'm going to spend it how I want. And it's that same attitude that all of us get. Now, some people listening to this are like, well, I don't do that, right? I don't split accounts. I don't, you know, say this is my money, this is your money. And maybe you don't. Maybe you don't have an issue with oneness or being one team. So, but maybe ask yourself another related question, which is, do you ever try to pull the Amazon package off the front step before your spouse sees it?
Okay, now you are stepping on toes. Now you're just being personal.
Yeah, that's just the same example of wanting to do what you want to do that causes other people to separate accounts entirely. It's the same thing.
Okay, fine. It's a position. I'm just saying. So it's a position of the heart. You know, I also wonder, too, if part of that, this, not that I mean, even if you have the same, even if you find, hey, we have the same values, we're both savers or we're both spenders or blah, blah, blah. Even if you have, you know, if you've checked that one off the list, but in your heart of hearts, you know, you keep a running tab. If it's not in a separate account, you still kind of keep that running total in your mind of, hey, this is what I earned. And so I'm planning to do this and that. I don't need.
Yeah.
I mean, is part of it a sense of feeling vulnerable? This idea of saying, look, everything I have is yours and everything. I'm handing it all over. I'm all in with you. I'm giving up my right to be the captain of my financial ship. I mean, is part of that an issue of vulnerability? Because, I mean, it does take some surrender.
Well, it takes vulnerability. And I'm, again, let me go back to the first thing that I stepped on toes. It also takes a willingness to say, you know, if I'm really going to be one with my spouse and my spouse fundamentally wants to handle money differently than I think is right, that I have to be willing to listen to them and like take that seriously as opposed to, oh, well, they just don't understand how money works. And that's a really uncomfortable place. Like I will take a guess that anyone who's kept listening after the first announcement that this hour of your live show was going to be on Thriving in Love and Money, my guess is that you probably lost a good number of people who went, yeah, I don't want to be thinking about money. And that the types of person, probably, hopefully not a ton, but that the types of person who is willing to, oh, this is interesting, let's listen to a show on money and relationship, they're probably more the financial planning type. They're probably more the type that has like a way that they think is right. And that type of person, I mean, that's awesome. There's nothing wrong with that, right? That's a gift from God in some way. But that type of person also may have a surprising difficulty with being one team with a spouse who just doesn't see things the same way. And the sort of financial planner type spouse is always trying to get them to change their mind, always trying to get them to see the light, and yet not necessarily going, wow, maybe I'm not trying to be one team in unity and oneness with my spouse. Maybe I'm trying to get my way. Like, that's an uncomfortable thought for somebody who just thinks their way is right. And their spouse may not be able to explain it with all the books and all the tools and everything in the same way. But both of these people brought together in this marriage by God, they're both there. They're both sharing life. They're supposed to be as much as they can one. And so it's both vulnerability. Like, you can't try to protect yourself. You have to be all in. But it's also a different type of vulnerability of being able to say, you know, maybe I need to start being willing to listen more to what my spouse finds important about this, even if it's what I think is completely different financially.
Yeah, it also seems to me that as you were describing that, you know, giving over and, you know, not just trying to get your spouse to do what's right, quote unquote, with the money, because you're pretty convinced you're right. And here's what would convince you you're right. I mean, if you've read all the books and you're looking only at the bottom line economics of it, then you might have a right economic answer. I guess I'm not disputing that. And I think economics, good economics is important. But when it comes down to it, you have to settle the question, I think, what is of greater value and preeminent importance? Is it the absolute best economic plan that you can have for your family? Or is it being responsible economically, but valuing your spouse more than individual money decisions? In a way, it comes down to that, because there may be times when you're in that relationship conversation and your spouse, what they're proposing or what they desire or what they value isn't going to get to the bottom line, absolute most economically wise decisions. And you go, okay, you know what? Let's sacrifice that, because I value you. Even if I don't value what you value, I value you. I value peace in our relationship. I value you feeling heard.
Well, and to be able to actually talk about it where both people feel kind of safe to have that conversation. I mean, it's interesting. Jeff and I were speaking at a church in the middle of the country on this topic just a couple months ago. And when we were doing the book signings afterwards, there was this sweet couple that came up to us, and they had three kids who looked like they were sort of young elementary school, and then one of them looked like they were 12. One of the kids was 12-ish. And, you know, the husband's like, we're getting out of debt, you know, we're not spending any money until, you know, we make sure that we pay down all of the credit card debt and, you know, student loan and whatever. And he was very, very focused. He seemed like a really, really good guy. Like, he cared about his wife, he cared about his kids, and clearly felt he was doing this for them. And the wife tells me, kind of off to the side, I want to go to, like, Disney World with the kids before they're this age. Like, the 12-year-old is already kind of past the really fun ages, but it's going to cost us, like, $5,000 to go to Disney World. And so, yeah, I guess we'll, you know, be going when they're, like, you know, 16 or so. And that was an example of, you know, is that a worthwhile conversation? Let's just put it that way. Is that a worthwhile conversation to say maybe the greatest economic good in some ways would be to get out of debt immediately and go to Disney World later? But maybe there's something to be said for going, you know what? We do need to do certain things while the kids are a certain age. And that means, if that means pushing off the debt plan for a couple of years, that's worth the trade-off. That's the kind of thing that nobody can make that decision for you, right? Like, that is not something that any financial planner can tell you this is the right way.
But it's also not a decision that one person should make.
Correct.
That, I think that's what I hear you saying, is it's a decision that you, whatever you come up with, you can feel good that you made it together, even if it means one person had to sacrifice a little bit more than they thought. That is such a great example, actually, because that's really where the rubber hits the road. That's the kind of stuff we wrestle with. I want to just ask you, before our time is up, you have found in your research that some of the problem are just underlying faulty beliefs. Explain what you found and what we need to be cautious about.
Yeah, some of the faulty beliefs, they're the kinds of things that are these little things down inside. You have knee-jerk reactions to stuff, and you don't necessarily know why. And it's things like, for example, ownership, like this idea that, you know, I should be able to spend this money the way that I want to spend it because I earned it. Like, you have this idea in your head that you kind of own that money, as opposed to what we were talking about before, which is, it's actually not your money and my money, it's our money. So that's an example of something that's a faulty belief that's causing this knee-jerk reaction. Those kinds of things are down in there from childhood, they're down in there from all sorts of places. And it's really important to actually, and it's kind of fun, actually, to be able to talk to your spouse whenever you recognize that you have sort of a knee-jerk reaction. You know, like for me, Christmas was horrible for me because one of my knee-jerk reactions is fear of missing out. Like, and there's all these sales. And I'm like, oh my gosh, my favorite store has 75% off. I mean, retailers are really good at triggering FOMO, right? And so, but that's an example of, now that I recognize that I have these things down deep, this fear of missing out, I can actually go to Jeff and go, okay, I'm like, talk me through this. I'm having this real desire to go to that favorite store and get a cute tunic or whatever, just because it's 75% off, which is stupid, but it's in there.
Because if it were not 75% off, you wouldn't have an urge to have it. But that is funny, because just even having somebody to talk those things through, being able to let that be part of your relationship dynamic, that it's not off limits, that it's not going to be a grenade thrown in the middle of your relationship, just to have that sense of peace that, hey, our relationship can go in all of these places. These are all of these things that we share. What, just even have that vision, if you're not there yet, to have that picture that you could get there. That's what I think this conversation has done. I love that in the back of your book, which I got in my hot little hand here, has what you call, it's a template for talking through some of these things. And it just basically is a little conversation starter in some of the five big areas that we talked about, with sort of a main point to remember. You know, there's not a right and not a wrong. You're trying to just figure out how you feel. But it's literally has a quote of things that you could talk about. Because for some of us, that's what we need. We need to know what is the entry point into this conversation that isn't going to be loaded with emotion or accusation. Yeah,
exactly. Well, we also have like a free assessment online where literally it takes 5 minutes. And you can just say, you know, oh, wow, here's some of the things that are going to be my triggers, for example, or what were yours? And it gives you, here's my list, here's your list. Oh, interesting. Like, it just gives you something to start with that's really simple, something to talk about. Because honestly, even if the only question you ask your spouse is, what one thing could I do to make it more easy for you to talk about money with me? Like, even if that's the only question you ask your spouse, wow, that will get you started.
I love it. Where can we find that assessment?
ThriveInLoveAndMoney.com. That's the website where all the research is and everything.
Shanti, thank you so much. It's always a delight to have you. We count you as a friend.
Thanks so much.
Well, she has made it very easy for us to choose our friend foray for today. Head over to ThriveInLoveAndMoney.com and take the free assessment that our friend Shanti Feldhum has made available. It's a chance for you to figure out how you score in love and money. A lot of couples have a hard time communicating. This could be a tool that you could use together. Maybe you'll start out separately, and then maybe you'll invite your spouse to take the journey with you. Perhaps even listening to this podcast together would be helpful. Certainly, I would recommend something that would be helpful is to pick up a copy of the book that Shanti and her husband Jeff have written, Thriving in Love and Money, 5 Game-Changing Insights About Your Relationship, Your Money, and Yourself. Because at the end of the day, it's not about the money. It's always about the relationship. All right, we're so glad that you spent time with us today. Be sure to recommend the Art of Friendship podcast to someone that you know, someone who cares about relationships. That is what we are about. And if you're enjoying this podcast, then let me recommend to you a stop over at hopeondemand.com, where there are some other great podcasts that I know that you'll enjoy. And of course, I would love for you to pick up a copy of my book, The Art of Friendship, Creating and Keeping Relationships That Matter. That does it. Until next time, my lovelies, remember, keep friending with purpose.